Turning now to Psalm 119 and verse 18. Psalm 119, verse 18. Open thou mine eyes, that I may behold wondrous things out of thy law. And I'm continuing our series, The Dissolving of Doubts. And this evening, we'll consider some doubts about Scripture. In a way, I'm rather reluctant to do this because it means looking at negative, alleged discrepancies in Scripture and answering them off. And it can be a tedious operation. And really, I set out to deal with believers' doubts. And many of these are not believers' doubts, but they're doubts which others are given by those who hate the word of God and the gospel, and we have to try to give them light and understanding and show them past those doubts. However, so it is necessary to look at this kind of matter once in a while, but I shall try to do it so as to encourage our own souls at the same time. I'm going to spend a single study on this and perhaps just one more study along these lines, which will be about doubts of doctrine, and one particular doctrine which people mostly sometimes have doubts about, but I'll save that to another time. Now, a national newspaper has been promoting a book written in 2016, and the title of the book, you may have seen the advertisements, is The Bible for Grown-Ups. Very patronising kind of title. A book, published last year. The author of the book, a man named Simon Loveday, passed away in February of this year at the age of 67. And he wrote a book in a very friendly, easy, pleasant style. And he claims that it isn't a book which is against belief or for belief. It's simply to enable people who'd like to have this to develop an adult view, a grown-up view, as he calls it, of the Bible. You soon discover when you read the book, and it is very popular, and it's being used in many schools, I understand, also to teach youngsters, but in this book, well, you soon discover that his main mission is to destroy any notions people may have that the Bible is inspired and infallible. In fact, really, all he sees in it is some wonderful literature here and there. But as a book, it's unhistorical, unreliable, and he brings against it all the usual criticisms, the kind of criticisms that you'll find in other books by more shrill atheists, like the Dawkins works and so on. Well, this is much more gentle and much more convincing in style, but no less crafty in its construction. And never will you hear the other side of any argument or any point of view. You will constantly hear of theories against the Bible which have long since been demolished, but you won't hear about that. You'll be given the impression that these are current and unassailable criticisms. So it follows those lines. It's an extremely antagonistic book. Now, the author, he's not a theologian. He's not a minister. He studied, I think, social anthropology at Cambridge as a young man, and then modern languages and English. So he's been to Cambridge and London and Oxford, and then eventually became a psychotherapist, I think, and a kind of spare time amateur literary critic. But the last few years, he's turned his attention very much to the Bible. And he represents a sad case of the opposite of Psalm 119, verse 18. Open thou mine eyes, that I may behold wondrous things out of thy law. He doesn't see any of the wonders of the Bible. He doesn't see, this poor man, any of the spiritual aspects of the Bible. He looks at it only in what he thinks is a scientific and rational manner, in order that his readers may become grown up. And it says a lot of things which would surprise you. Well, you know, the incarnation narratives in Matthew and Luke, well, that's just an adult version of Santa Claus, and contradictory and without foundation, and all the usual criticisms. Well, some people are shaken by these things. Believers don't usually read those kind of books, young people in particular. So we will look at some aspects of this kind of thing. His main purpose is to popularize liberal theological criticism of the Bible. And that's what he seeks to do. I'm going to start, really. There's so much you could say about this work, and it's just a number of things which might benefit us that I shall pick out. Constantly, his book makes unsubstantiated assertions that he doesn't even attempt to justify. Many of them are completely out-of-date ideas that have been long since debunked, but he states them as though they're verified facts, and then without any references a little later on, he'll build on them. So he lays a foundation, and later on he'll refer back to this as though he's proved it, which he hasn't, and he'll make all kinds of assertions. I give you an example. Very early in the book it appears that none of the Old Testament, even the oldest books, were committed to writing until after 900 BC. So a little later on he's able to say, well, having established that nothing was written before 900 BC, you can see an enormous gap between the events recorded in the book of Genesis and their first being committed to writing. In the case of the history of Abraham, it's anything between 1,000 and 1,200 years. In the case of the history of Moses, it's 500 to 600 years before there was any writing of it. So it's left to our imagination how much inaccuracy could come about by that time, how much embellishment, how many mistakes, mistakes even in transcription documents, and so on. So this is the way he goes about demolishing the possibility of any accuracy in the records of the Bible. He has a fast-moving review of ancient history, a history of all nations in Bible times, which really serves to shrink the significance of the Hebrew people. They're just a small irrelevance in all of world history. And he sees nothing in this strange course of ancient history. You know, ancient history is remarkable. It's very extraordinary the way powerful nations like Egypt rise up, become all-controlling, and then collapse almost at a stroke and fizzle out one after another. Whether it's the Assyrians, one empire after another, the Chaldeans, the Persians, the Romans, so on, all of them attain tremendous power and accomplishment and then rapidly decline. It defies all reason, all sense, until you realize that the ancient world was being superintended by God, as the Bible claims, to fit in his aspirations for his people and the history of Israel. And so nations rise and nations fall. Psalm 75, God is the judge. He putteth down one and setteth up another. And that's explained on nearly a dozen different occasions in the Old Testament, and established and proved. And you look at ancient history, it defeats all explanation, unless you see a divine hand moulding it, sculpting it, dealing with it, with cycles of judgment and warnings and so on. I gave Egypt for you, Seba and Sheba for you, says God through the lips of Isaiah. He's never realized that, the author. He's never grasped the mysteries of ancient history, the evidence of God's hand explained only in terms of the Bible. But anyway, here's just a little, before we turn to texts, of his emasculated view of the Old Testament. What's the Pentateuch about? What's it all about? Oh, he says, it's how we Jews gained the kingdom. Well then, what are the historical books about? Oh, they're how we lost the kingdom. Well, what are the... This is all old hat, liberal assessment of the Bible, but he parrots it all. What are the prophetic books? Why we lost the kingdom? And what's the significance of the other books, such as the Psalms? Oh, they're just miscellaneous, the writings. They don't fit. They're not in the broad scheme of things. Now you think of it, how we gained the kingdom, the promised land, how we lost it, why we lost it, and miscellaneous. What else is there in the Old Testament? Nothing. Isn't there any prophecy? No. No prophecy. That's not recognized. No promises of God. Well, isn't there a fall and a response from God? A plan of redemption unfolded in the Old Testament? No. You see the text I picked this evening. Open thou mine eyes, that I may behold wondrous things out of thy law. The author doesn't see any of that. It isn't there. If he reads the Bible at all, his mind glazes over when he looks at the mass of passages that analyze the human situation, that define it, that describe the fall and sin and God's remedy and the plan of salvation. When believers read the Bible, that's what they see. But when somebody who is approaching the Bible through the eyes of scientific rationalism reads the Bible, they see none of that. They're unaware of it. They pass it over. It isn't there. There's no sign of Christ. There's no sign of the eternal state. There's no sign of redemption. Oh, he says, there's no trace of any messianic expectation among the Jews until about the first century BC. Really? It's all gone out of the Bible. That's what many school children are being taught. It isn't there. How astonishing. Well, friends, there's nothing about morality in the Old Testament. There's nothing about the afterlife until perhaps the second half of the book of Daniel, which of course the author tells us wasn't written until after 200 BC anyway. Well, what makes him think that? That's only an assertion of unbelieving critical scholarship, completely unproven. The opposite now is being quite strongly asserted, even by many liberal theologians, that the literature of Daniel is much earlier than that, much more in keeping with its claimed date. However, none of that. So the Bible, the spiritual aspect and purpose of its history is gone. The religion of the Hebrews in Old Testament times, he says, was purely earthly, for your well-being, for your earthly prosperity and peace and fertile territory and so on. It had nothing to do with any spiritual or eternal connotation. So that's the stripped down, emasculated, narrowed down view of the Old Testament which is being put forward. Same as in the books of the mainline atheists, in today's militant atheism, Hitchens, Dawkins, and so on. But this is put in a more dangerous, because friendly, kind of manner. It isn't, as I said before, anything like so shrill. Now we know, he says, that the accounts of the patriarchs in the book of Genesis is unhistorical. We know it has no reference to literal events. How? Well, for example, it mentions the Philistines and the Arameans, and they didn't exist. They didn't exist, he asserts, until the 12th century. Well, that is often asserted. But of course, it's a nonsense, because when the Philistines come into being or appear on the world stage in the 12th century BC, they come as a fully fledged people. They come as a developed people. Same with the Arameans, with sophisticated sculptures and so on. They were not a new people, a new nation. They were established and had been for centuries. Of course, it is unhistorical to make comments like that. The Bible is a credible history book. If it has Arameans and Philistines on the scene, their nations originating in the early stages of the Bible, they were there. And ultimately, that will be vindicated. And you get foolish remarks. There are camels in Genesis, the writer asserts. Well, camels were not domesticated, he tells us, until the 12th century BC. Well, whose idea is that? That's only an opinion. That's not a fact. And these kind of ideas are picked up and made the basis of criticism of the scripture. Let me give you one that you probably heard quite often. There is no evidence at all of the 400-year presence of the Hebrews in captivity in Egypt. There is no evidence for that outside the Bible ever having occurred at all. Now, this writer, Simon Loveday, puts it differently, and this is not exclusive to him or original with him, but he puts it like this. There is absolutely no record in the Egyptian historical records of any presence of Israelites or Hebrews in Egypt during that period of oppression. That's a very strong statement. Is it true? Well, the first answer is, yes, it's true. Is it right? Well, no, it isn't right. Well, how can both be true? Well, I'll tell you the situation. It's easy to describe. The Pharaoh of the oppression, there are historical records for the time of the Pharaoh of the oppression and the latter part of the oppression and the Exodus. Do they mention the Hebrew people being there in captivity? No, they don't. Now, when we make these kind of remarks, I expect you've got in your mind a picture of an archive somewhere with hundreds and hundreds of files and historical records and much detail about the situation of Egypt at that time. Well, in fact, there's no archive. Of course, there's no paper records. The only records, there was writing, but mainly the Pharaoh's records are inscriptions, clay inscriptions. But for the Pharaoh of the Exodus and the latter part of the oppression, here's what you'd have to do to read them. You go to Cairo, and you go to the National Museum of Egypt, and there in a heavily protected room are the records of the Egyptian historical records, you may call them grandly, of the Pharaoh of the Exodus. They're in quite a small case. I've never seen them, but I've seen the pictures. And in that case is a single fragment of a tablet measuring about 2 inches by 1.5 inches. Is that all there is? Yes, that's all there is. And the interpretation of what is on that fragment appears to be, so it is thought, a portion of a complaint in a letter between Pharaoh, one way or the other, and one of the regional rulers about a treaty they appear to have had. At least that's what it's thought to be about. And that's all there is. There are no other records. They don't exist. So you see, if somebody says to you, in all the historical records of Egypt, there is no reference to the Hebrews having been in Egypt for 400 years, but that's the only record there is. There's nothing else to examine or to look. It's a perfectly true statement, but don't be convinced by it, because there aren't any records. Oh, there are, just one bit, which has nothing to do with the matter in hand. Isn't a record of families or population or the business of Egypt or anything like that. Isn't there anything else? Well, for other pharaohs, yes, there are inscriptions, but all they do is idolize the pharaoh and his major conquests and battles, or a few of them, because he's a god, you see, in the eyes of the Egyptians. And there's no setbacks, no losses. If a pharaoh lost getting on for 2 million people who got out and lost his troops in the process of trying to chase them, that would certainly never go into any inscription, even if there was one to be found. So some of these things are technically correct and yet utterly incorrect and absurd at the same time. The record that you have of the oppression of the children of Israel in Egypt is in this historical work, the Old Testament of the Bible. Now, is there any evidence at all you could put alongside that? Well, there is, indirectly, and some of you have seen it, or you've seen artifacts connected with it in the British Museum. It's nothing direct, but there's plenty which is indirect, in that the narratives in the book of Genesis describe the life in Egypt and the oppression in very detailed ways. And various excavations in Egypt have established, and material that has come to the surface, that those descriptions are absolutely true to life for the Egypt of those days. The descriptions are accurate and right. This is contemporary reporting and literature, things that nobody expected to be right in the course of archaeological discovery were shown to be bang on and absolutely accurately describing the circumstances of the children of Israel in Egypt. It isn't direct, it's indirect, but to say there is no evidence is untrue. There's a great deal of that kind of evidence. Then here's another comment. The Mount Sinai has never been found. Is that true or false? Well, it's true. Nobody for certain knows which mountain in Arabia, and I'm using the term Arabia in the biblical sense, it's a very broad term, no one knows which hill or mountain was Mount Sinai, where precisely it was. Some people think it's in Saudi Arabia these days. There's quite a lot of evidence for that. Others think no, in the Sinai Peninsula. But either way, nobody knows where it is. But there are a number of extremely good candidates. There are 13 Mount Sinais claimed by the various experts, so to speak, in this field. It's not as though there's no suitable mountain. There are 13 candidates which broadly answer to the description in the Bible. So it's not as though anyone can say, Mount Sinai, there isn't such a mountain. There isn't any feasible place. This is pure fiction. But they make it sound like that. No one's discovered Mount Sinai. What did they expect to find? A flagpole on the top with a coat of arms of Moses left on the top, or something of that kind. But there are 13 candidates that competing for the place. And any Christian can well imagine why God saw fit to ensure that nobody could identify the exact place in modern times. Just think what would happen there, and how it would be claimed and idolized and gold-plated and made an object of worship and so on. But these kind of exaggerations in these books abound. Joshua's conquest. There's no evidence, it's asserted, that Joshua ever conquered Canaan and entered in and the conquest. What do they mean, there's no evidence? There's no evidence of a change of culture in the land. Well, actually, that's not right. There are quite a few excavations and workers have pointed out a change of culture. Now, you know that when the great British archaeologist Kathleen Kenyon excavated Jericho, she spent many years at it, and she wrote a long report, much of which wasn't published until some 16, 17 years after her death. And in her initial summary report before she died, she did not think that Jericho had been conquered by the Israelites. She put its conquest, its collapse, much later on. And she didn't see any evidence of a change of culture. At least that's what she thought. But then others, when they went through her thousands of sheets of notes and details and drawings and pictures and so on, interpreted them quite differently. And some dozen years after her death, the strain of publications changed. And the experts were saying, this is undoubtedly a 15th century BC conquest. And here is all the evidence. And Dame Kathleen Kenyon had it, but she didn't interpret it along those lines. But even from her own notes and things that she removed and evidences and subsequent excavations have said that the good dame was digging in the wrong place for many things, and excavating other areas has found much evidence for change of culture. So now the conquest by the Hebrews at Jericho is much more firmly established than it ever was. But these books often quote old material, and they're by no means up to date, and they're not up with the times. But I mention these things because maybe your children are being told some of this kind of thing. It's almost worth reading books like this and going through them yourself and drawing out the evidence. There's no evidence, it's said, for the reigns of King David or the reigns of King Solomon. Well, there isn't much. It's quite true. It's surprising in a way. There isn't much more. No doubt it'll come over the years. But to say there's nothing isn't correct. There is something. 1993, this is quite a few years ago now, the Tel Dan Eldan inscription was found, which names a king of David's house being punished by two other kings, and it's a famous inscription. And probably it was Hazael of Damascus defeating Jehoram and Ahaziah. But there's an inscription which very likely describes that. But I'm going in a short time to look at a number of texts. And I turn first of all to Genesis 9 and verse 2. And here are some of the criticisms of the Old Testament. What sort of God is in the Old Testament? What sort of morality is this? The cry goes up. Chapter 9. And God blessed Noah and his sons and said unto them, be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth, and the fear of you and the dread of you shall be upon every beast of the earth and upon every fowl of the air, upon all that moveth, upon the earth and upon all the fishes of the sea. Into your hand are they delivered. And this is supposed to be, a criticism is, what awful morality is taught here. What kind of an awful God is this who instills fear and so on? But this is foolishness, because this is a very kind provision of God in the narrative. that when Noah and his family set foot on the earth, and as the only human beings faced the animal kingdom, so-called, and so on, God will ensure that they are safe and that they are superior, and that the animals, one way or another, will be afraid of them. Well, instinctively, we think of lions and tigers being afraid of us. Well, they're afraid of things we can do. They keep away if we light a fire, and they're quite tameable and controllable and capturable and confinable. So in a sense, as long as we're careful, the passage is true, we're given a certain protection and safety because we can prevail over all the animals, and many of them will be naturally afraid, and all of them afraid of something we can do, and it's for protection and safety. What awful morality is reflected in such a provision for the human race? And then there's the protection which the author hasn't bothered to read on, to see the strictures against shedding man's blood and so on that follow this very passage. But the children are being told that the Old Testament is an immoral book. Then I can turn to Leviticus 25 and verse 44. And this is about slavery. The Bible allows slavery. Both thy bondmen and thy bondmaids, which thou shalt have, shall be of the heathen that are round about you. Of them shall ye buy bondmen and bondmaids. And then are the prescriptions and the terms on which the Hebrews may draw slaves from the nations round about them. And yes, it's there as a provision in the Old Testament, in the laws of the Old Testament that were only for a time, that would be done away with the coming of Messiah. They mustn't use their own people as slaves, but from the pagan nations, the nations about, they could buy slaves and they could use them in their households. And that was for that time and for that place. But other provisions provide for those slaves being well treated. And in the society of those days, there's a benevolent aspect in this. And yes, there is slavery in the Old Testament, but it's regulated and it's bound, and it's not for the Israelites themselves, and it's for that time and for that place. But this is something to get worked up about and to be greatly offended by. And then I turn quickly to Deuteronomy and chapter 21, and here is a great complaint in verse 18. If a man have a stubborn and rebellious son, which will not obey the voice of his father or the voice of his mother, and that when they have chastened him, will not hearken unto them, then shall his father and his mother lay hold on him, and bring him out unto the elders of his city, and unto the gate of his place. And they shall say unto the elders of his city, this our son is stubborn and rebellious. He will not obey our voice. He is a glutton and a drunkard. And the men of his city shall stone him with stones that he die. So shalt thou put evil away from among you, and all Israel shall hear and fear. Terrible is the charge against this. And certainly, to our ears, it sounds extremely strict. But just think for a moment. How crazy would a son be to get himself stoned? Now, I don't think I was ever, even in unregenerate times, a drunkard and a glutton, and a rebel, yes. I think you've all been rebels. We have the freedom to be rebels today in too many ways. But I can't imagine that if I knew there was a sanction like that, I would take this all the way to the wire and not accept any chastisement or any warning until I was taken off to the elders of the city. This is a kind of nuclear option. You can't imagine that button ever being pushed, but you can imagine the effect it would have on youngsters growing up to enforce the fifth commandment and to make sure that they maintained respect within reasonable grounds of protest over all sorts of things, but ultimately respect for their parents and for the older generation. Can you imagine a lout of 18 taking this all away? Surely he would repent and make a few promises before he got anywhere near the city elders with the stones lying in tubs to hand. This is a kind of nuclear option. Somebody caught in a terrible crime might have to be stoned, but a rebellious son, well, it would be interesting to know if this were ever actually done, if there were any rebellious sons crazy enough to pursue this all the way and to hold out to the final sanction. Anyway, I just offer that to you. It's there in this book, but I would think that it had a tremendous effect. I'm not saying we should adopt it today. These ancient laws are finished and gone. They're for that time and for that place, and Christ has come. But there it is. I think to get everybody worked up as though this happened every week in every market square is a bit absurd, and I just make those comments to you. Well, friends, I could go to Deuteronomy 28 and verse 56, but this is the order of complaints that you get. The tender and delicate woman among you, which would not adventure to set the sole of her foot upon the ground for delicateness and tenderness. I don't think there is such a person, but the narrative puts before our imagination an extreme of delicacy and tenderness here. Her eye shall be evil toward the husband of her bosom. In other words, you read on, she'll be prepared to execute and eat him, the passage says, and towards her son, and towards her daughter, and towards her young one that cometh out from between her feet, born from her, and toward her children, which she shall hear, for she shall eat them for want of all things, secretly in the siege and straitness, wherewith thine enemy shall distress thee in thy gates. Now we're told, what shocking morality! What sort of a God is this? But these are people who've rejected God, and his hand of protection, after many warnings, has been removed from them. And so an enemy has come, and they're under siege because of their foolishness, exposed to the wrath of their enemies. And they indeed have become so sinful and so degraded and so corrupted as human beings that even a normally, you would think, delicate and tender woman will become a savage and stab her own children in the back in order to cook and eat them. This is terrible. But this is only a description, not of God's morality or God's rules, but of what man brings upon himself by extremes of sin and idolatry and abandonment of God and offended him. Then God no longer overrules in their defense, and they become subject to all kinds of horrors and terrors. This is what happens in time of war. God takes his protective arm away from a society or a nation, and it explodes into war, and people become subject to their own worst temperaments and ways. So it's a description of the plight and the position of man, not a description of what God does and wants to do to people. But they'll clutch at any old thing, in order to insinuate that God is not, or the God of the Bible, is a mythical God who isn't moral at all, and his standards constantly vary. I could turn to so many passages, but our time really is almost exhausted. I could have shown you passages where the author claims there are many gods, but it's a nonsense, because if you read the text, there's no suggestion of there being many gods among the Israelites. And then the claims are made that terrible things are sanctioned by the Old Testament record. When Lot offers his daughters to the men of Sodom rather than his male guests, the claim of this book is that the passage approves that. Passage doesn't approve it at all. Lot is not commended in any way for that unthinkable and desperate action. It's true, the angel of the Lord rescues him and his family, but there is no applause for him or approval for him for what he did in the heat of the moment, same as Lot's daughters who gave their father intoxicating drink and plied him with it in a drowsy state, and then, of course, went into him, as the Bible puts it, and children were born. Oh, the claim is the Bible commends that. Doesn't commend it at all. It doesn't condemn it, but it does indirectly, because the issue from that terrible event were the fathers of the Moabites and the Ammonites. So it's hardly a blessing that ultimately came out of that union. And then Abraham gives his wife Sarah, not once, but twice to a Pharaoh. And says the book, that's approved. It isn't approved. Where does he get that from? It isn't approved at all. In fact, Abraham finds himself in the position, when God delivers him, of being reproved by Pharaoh. In each case, and the second time, most severely. And he's humiliated by that reproof. There's no sanction of it. There's no commendation. And then all sorts of things are said. Moses marries Zipporah, and she's not one of the children of Israel. So Moses broke the law. And how is it that the Bible shows that that union is blessed, and yet a little while later, God is severely punishing many Hebrews for breaking it? You see, the author doesn't know his Bible. For one thing, obviously, Moses took Zipporah to wife long before the Lord gave that law. But in any case, even if the law not to marry the Canaanites had been in force at that time, Zipporah wasn't one of those Canaanite nations named in the law. She was a Midianite or Cushite, and that nation isn't mentioned. And besides which, it's clearly the Old Testament practice that if you had a wife who was a member of you were a Hebrew, and you had a wife who was one of the forbidden nations into which you were not supposed to marry, but that wife was a godly person who'd come to the God of Israel and worship correctly and so on, then it was in order. And that must have been the practice among them, because it's the only way of explaining how God approved of some such marriages and disapproved of others. And so in the book of the prophet Isaiah, it's put into formal law when Isaiah expounds this very point and at great length exonerates the stranger who is godly, can come in to the house of God, can enjoy as a stranger the blessings of Israel and marriage. That is obviously reflecting what was taught among the Hebrews up until that time. So it's looking for trouble. Nothing wrong with the union of Moses and Zipporah. Nothing wrong with the union of Ruth and Boaz for the same reason. One was not an Israelite, but was a godly woman and had come to the God of Israel. And that makes all the difference. Time is well and truly out. I'd like to tell you just one thing before I close. The incarnation. The birth of Christ. What a fantasy, they say. In Matthew's Gospel, Joseph and Mary lived in Bethlehem. Matthew's Gospel doesn't say that. It says Christ was born in Bethlehem. It doesn't say it was their home. It just doesn't give the details that Luke gives about the census and the journey from Nazareth to Bethlehem and that kind of thing. It isn't elaborated upon in Matthew's Gospel, but it's no contradiction. It doesn't say that they lived in Bethlehem at all. That's a big mistake. And anyway, here's the complaint. This is all wrong. The story that we find in Luke's Gospel about the birth of Christ and this census, this registration that would have had to have taken place about 4 BC for this to happen, there was no such registration. Well, for one thing, Cyrenius, as our King James Version calls him, the governor of Syria, he wasn't there then. He didn't come along until about AD 6. So the record's all wrong. When Augustus Caesar, he gave a demand for a census some years before. Now, you never tamper with Luke's Gospel. Luke's Gospel has been criticized many times down the years as being unhistorical. And every now and then another archaeological artifact arrives, which always shows Luke to have been correct and not his critics. It's a dangerous thing to say Luke is unhistorical. He's never wrong when the ground gives up its treasures. And so it is with this, because there is an inscription which shows that the governor of Syria had two shots at his governorship, one before Christ and one afterwards. So yes, he would have been on station for a census, which was a little earlier. And Augustus Caesar had ordered a census two or three or maybe as many as 6 years prior to the one that Luke mentions in connection with the journey from Nazareth to Bethlehem of Joseph and Mary. And these often took years to enact and to finish. And we now know, because there's evidence for this, that a Roman census had never previously, before this one in Luke, ever been applied to Palestine, to the Holy Land. And so it would have been way behind the general census. And it's spot on that it's very likely it was around 4 to 6 AD, BC rather, before Christ, when Cyrenius would have had his first shot as governor of Syria. And there is solid evidence for that. So they're plain wrong when they say Luke was wrong. Luke wasn't wrong. Luke's never been wrong when it comes to corroborative evidence from the archaeologists. Anyway, it confirms to us that the best minds that are highly antagonistic to the Bible, when you look at the details of what they're saying, they're always being unreasonable, unfair, inaccurate, generalizing. They haven't read the record properly. They've missed the point. They haven't understood what they're reading. It's always the case. But as I proved to you this evening, it's an awfully tiresome business having to trek it all through point by point to contradict each one of these allegations. But that is the campaign today. People are having their heads filled with this sort of thing in television documentaries, in books, parroted in the schools. It's a sad thing. Maybe we have to be much more aware of it, so that we can intelligently respond and help people if they're open to help. But back to my text, and I close in Psalm 119 and verse 18. Open thou mine eyes, that I may behold wondrous things out of thy law. Most of you here have had your eyes opened. And to you, you will be astonished at all these allegations and ideas. It's so plain in the scripture. They've missed the point. No eternity in the Old Testament. No spiritual material. No morality. No new life. No conversion. Nothing like that. Your eyes have been opened. You see it all. But how patient we have to be to those we serve whose eyes have not been opened, and try to show them these great things of the Lord. Let's close this evening singing the hymn 480, version 1. Hymn number 480.